Welcome to this audio issue of Best Buys, published and copyrighted by Porter & Company, all rights reserved. Please note that this recording was generated via AI and may contain minor transcription errors and pronunciation mistakes. Throughout this issue, I may reference charts, graphs, and imagery that can only be viewed on our website at porterandcompanyresearch.com. This issue was originally published on September 11, 2025. Fight the store, and the store wins. Direct-to-consumer is not all it's cracked up to be. How bottles and Al Capone disrupted milk delivery. It was 1934. Not a great time to be a Capone. The brains of the family, Al, also known as Public Enemy No. 1, was cooling his heels in Alcatraz prison for tax evasion, and President Franklin Roosevelt had just ended Prohibition and kneecapped the Capone's lucrative syndicate of speakeasies and moonshine. It was up to less famous brother Ralph, known as Public Enemy No. 3, to save the family business. He had options, after all: prostitution, gambling, beefing up the protection racket. He decided on milk. It wasn't a bad idea, actually. Ralph planned to import cheaper milk into Chicago from over the Wisconsin border, bottle it in the cheerfully named mob-owned Meadowmore Dairy, and then sell it in local grocery stores at 9 cents a quart, severely undercutting the 11-cent, locally produced milk that was price-fixed by the powerful Milk Wagon Drivers Union and delivered to customers' doors. As a sideline, the Capone family also forced many Chicago pizzerias to use rubbery Wisconsin-sourced mozzarella, still remembered with distaste in the area as mob cheese. Back then, milk wasn't routinely sold in stores. The milkman and the iceman, both needed in an age before widespread refrigeration, made daily rounds, and milk delivery was a nationwide business, protected by powerful unions. It was a direct-to-consumer business, no middleman needed, and all the profit went straight into the milk cartel's pockets. Until Ralph Bottles Capone came on the scene, that is. Bottles figured he'd price the milk delivery union out of business by selling his own cheaper milk in stores, then he'd be the milk cartel, and maybe Public Enemy No. 1 would be proud of him. So he opened the doors of Meadowmore Dairy, and a bomb immediately crashed in, courtesy of the milk deliverers. A watchman caught it while the fuse was still sputtering and threw it back outside onto South Peoria Street, where it exploded. That was the start of the milk wars, a surprisingly violent conflict that during the rest of the 1930s would include 11 more bombings, 22 smashed windows, an acid throwing, stolen and tipped over milk trucks, a grocery store set on fire, and a union man caught in a drive-by shooting, as the milk delivery union fought to defend their turf and bottles Capone's gang hit back. Through it all, Meadowmore milk kept selling for lower prices in the grocery store, eventually, just 8.5 cents per quart, even as delivery milk went up to 13 cents. As thousands of Chicago housewives saw a chance to pinch pennies, the 7,000 milk delivery routes in the city shrunk to 4,500. By 1938, union boss Steve Sumner claimed that 2,500 of his drivers were out of work thanks to Meadowmore's cheaper store milk. Eventually, in 1940, the mob and the drivers' union reached an uneasy ceasefire thanks to a Department of Justice-mediated consent decree. Independent Dairies, aka mob-owned Meadowmore, agreed to leave the milk union alone, while the union agreed to stop price-fixing and let independent dairies sell their milk in stores. But maybe without realizing it, Bottles Capone, who died peacefully in his bed in 1974, had sounded the first death knell of the direct-to-consumer milk industry. Death of a milkman. Meadowmore Dairy expanded beyond its mob roots and became a Chicago fixture. Empowered by the 1940 DOJ decree, it continued selling its cheaper milk in stores. As the 1940s progressed, more dairies followed Meadowmore's lead. Home refrigeration blazed onto the scene, as did steel thermos tanker trucks and one-time-use cardboard cartons. Baby boomer families moved farther from farms and settled nearer to supermarkets. Milk delivery routes grew longer and longer, driving costs rose, and the once-powerful drivers' unions shrank. By the 1970s, the milkmen had all but disappeared from the streets of America, and every grocery store had a well-stocked dairy aisle at the back, so you'd have to walk past all the other products in order to grab your half gallon. Big box retail had killed the direct-to-consumer milk industry, gang style. It was one of the first times the store shot the delivery service in the back of the head, but it wouldn't be the last. Fast forward a century, and companies, often flashy IPOs like Albert's or Warby Parker, routinely get the bright idea to forgo big box stores and sell their product directly to customers, usually on their own website or through ads on social media. Like milk delivery, it seems like a good idea at the time. What's not to love about reaching your customer base directly and pocketing all your profits without giving Walmart a cut? But long term, like milk delivery, it invariably fails. Direct to consumer, DTC, companies particularly ones that specialize in a single product, are vulnerable to supply chain issues, high online ad costs, shrinking reach, and diminishing demand in a way that brick-and-mortar storefronts just aren't. In 2022, as temporary COVID-fueled enthusiasm for online shopping wore off, nearly every publicly traded DTC company with a market cap of over $800 million lost money, shedding billions of dollars and underperforming an already dismal market, down 19% on average compared to the S&P's 11%. That year alone, bedeviled by supply chain snarls and higher shipping costs from China, former DTC darling Stitch Fix, Clothing Boxes, and Warby Parker, eyeglasses, fell 40%, and Allbirds, shoes, dropped 64%. Just look at what happened to Casper, perhaps the poster child for DTC failure, the much-hyped mattress in a box, which you'd order online and then unfold while it fluffed out to its full glory, reached $1.1 billion valuation in 2019, 6 years after its launch. But sleepers only need so many mattresses, and the high cost of Facebook ads quickly ate up the company's profits. By the time Casper limped to an IPO in 2020, its value was down to $476 million. It went private the following year at $6.90 per share. Today, you can still buy a Casper mattress from a brick-and-mortar mattress store. The same fate befell Warby Parker. Visit the Warby Parker kiosk at Target, Allbirds, now selling at a Dick's Sporting Goods near you, and Smile Direct Club, the online orthodontics company, is now bankrupt, so just visit your local dentist. They all fought the store, and the store won. Our top best buys today was almost one of these statistics. It pivoted sharply to DTC, a hell of a drug, and sales slumped severely. Today, though, the company is helmed by a new and sensible CEO whose top priority has been getting its product back into major retailers, with encouraging results that are reflected in recent earnings. If you're not already a subscriber to Best Buys, click here to learn more. Or call Lance James, our Director of Customer Care, at 888-610-8895 or internationally at +1-443-815-4447 for more information on getting access to this new publication. 1. Nike, NYSE, NKE. In this issue, we're adding shoe and apparel maker Nike, NYSE, NKE, into our latest Best Buys recommendations, which will replace ride-sharing platform Uber Technologies, NYSE, Uber. While we remain bullish on Uber, we believe Nike offers one of the most attractive risk/reward opportunities in today's market. Why we recommended Nike? In prior issues, we've written about the strategic blunders Nike made under its previous management team. Specifically, the company's lack of investment into new shoe innovation, and its decision to pull back from brick-and-mortar retail distribution in order to cut out the middlemen and sell shoes directly to consumers. Both of these actions backfired, causing Nike to lose market share to its longtime rivals like Adidas and New Balance, and newer entrants like Hoka and On Running. The reason for our bullish view now is the rapid progress new CEO Elliott Hill is making in turning around the business, which we believe the market has failed to appreciate. In less than a year on the job, Hill has completely overhauled Nike's upper management team, including replacing 12 of his 15 lieutenants. With new leadership in place, the company is doubling down on the simple formula that made it great in the first place. This includes a renewed focus on beefing up research and development, R&D, toward new shoe designs, like the hit Alphafly 3 carbon fiber running shoe that's received rave reviews for its comfortable and lightweight design, less than 7 ounces. Nike is also investing into limited edition sneakers that have generated renewed buzz around the brand, including the Neon Air Max 95 and Asia Wilson-owned sneakers. Nike is also flexing its marketing muscle, the long-running advantage the business has enjoyed by having the largest advertising budget in the industry. CEO Hill increased Nike's marketing budget 9% in fiscal year 2025 to $4.7 billion, more than its next three largest rivals combined. This contributed to successful new campaigns like Your Choice, centered around its latest running shoes like Pegasus, Vomero, and Structure. With successful new designs and more spending on demand creating, Nike's running shoe sales increased by mid-single digits in the latest quarter, indicating a re-acceleration in brand momentum after several years of flatlining sales. Meanwhile, Nike is rekindling its relationships with key brick-and-mortar retailers, including industry leader Foot Locker, where Nike shoes now occupy the largest amount of shelf space among all footwear brands. And with Foot Locker recently announcing a merger with fellow footwear giant Dick's Sporting Goods, Nike is in prime position to reclaim its former dominant position as the leader in retail shelf space. Finally, Hill has also aggressively worked down Nike's bloated inventories of stale merchandise. We measure inventory in terms of days of supply, meaning the number of days required to sell down existing merchandise. In his first three quarters as CEO, Hill has brought Nike's inventories down from a near-record high of 112 days to 103 days in the latest quarter, or below the five-year average of 106 days. Why Nike is a best buy? Each of these actions, including more R&D and marketing spending, and cutting prices to move inventory, all present a near-term drag on profitability, but they're setting the stage for what we see as the ultimate endgame, a return to Nike's historic ability to generate mid-single-digit revenue growth and mid-teens profit margins. If Hill continues executing on the turnaround plan, we see a scenario where Nike's revenue increases from $46 billion currently to $60 billion over the next 4 years. Currently, we see a scenario where profit margins return to historic levels of 13%, resulting in just under $8 billion in net income by 2029. With the company continuing to funnel its excess free cash flow into share repurchases along the way, we expect that to translate into earnings per share of $7 by 2029, with the shares commanding a 25x price-to-earnings multiple, working out to a share price target of $175. From its current share price of $75, that works out to a compounded annual return of 24%. Nike currently trades at one of its lowest valuations on record, at just 2.4x price to sales, or a more than 30% discount to its 10-year average of 3.5x. Nike's profit margins have been squeezed as part of an intentional turnaround plan that involves a short-term profit hit in exchange for investing in long-term growth. The market's lackluster expectations that this turnaround effort will bear fruit. We believe this short-term profit hit and pessimism regarding Nike's new strategic focus have created a tremendous buying opportunity for long-term investors. Action to take: buy Nike, NYSE, NKE, up to $100 per share. 2. Eli Lilly, NYSE, LLY. Eli Lilly, NYSE, LLY, is the global leader in the booming market for GLP-1 diabetes and weight loss drugs. Why we recommended Eli Lilly? The GLP-1 weight loss drug market is at a competitive crossroads. Eli Lilly displaced the former industry leader, Novo Nordisk, NVO, achieving 50% market share earlier this year, and the trend continued in its latest Q2 earnings results, released on August 7, when Lilly gained 57% share. Sales of Lilly's top-selling product, the diabetes treatment Mounjaro, grew 68% year-on-year, YI, to reach $5.2 billion in Q2. Zepbound, Lilly's other GLP-1 offering for weight management, generated $3.4 billion of sales in the quarter, with sales up by an incredible 172% YI for the quarter. Both drugs have the same active ingredient, tirzepatide, which stimulates insulin release to help lower blood sugar and suppress appetite. The two drugs make up 55% of Eli Lilly's sales, and their rapid growth contributed to a 38% YI increase in revenue, which reached $15.56 billion in Q2. While earnings per share, EPS, jumped 61% to $6.31. The company boosted its 2025 expected revenue to $61 billion, up from a previous estimate of $59.5 billion, while expected EPS rose to $21.48, up from $20.92 previously. Already, the booming sales of Eli Lilly's GLP-1 drugs have made it one of the fastest-growing pharmaceutical companies in the world. Since the 2022 launch of Mounjaro, the company's revenue has increased 20% each year, and this trend is expected to continue through at least 2029, when sales are expected to cross over the $100 billion mark. Why Eli Lilly is a best buy? So far, the main GLP-1 drugs on the market come in an injectable form, including Mounjaro and Zepbound, as well as Novo Nordisk's Ozempic and Wegovy. More recently, big pharma companies are racing to create the first pill form of the drug, which should open up a massive new source of demand from consumers who don't want to take the drug via injections. But oral GLP-1s have had some snags. Pfizer, PFE, was forced to discontinue two of its oral GLP-1 drugs because of adverse reactions in the liver. Novo Nordisk's Rybelsus drug failed to achieve the same efficacy of its injectables. Eli Lilly was thought to be the current leader in this race with its new oral GLP-1 pill Orforglipron, based in large part by management's positive commentary on the promising early clinical data. Going into the August 7 earnings call, investors were expecting the company to show results indicating at least 15% loss in body weight. But on the company's Q2 earnings call, the latest data released from a Phase 3 trial of Orforglipron showed the pill producing an average weight loss of just 12.4% over 72 weeks at its highest dose. This result was less than the current competing drug under development by Novo Nordisk, an oral form of semaglutide, the same active ingredient in Wegovy, which showed 15.1% weight loss in a drug trial lasting 68 weeks. Despite the setback, we believe this is a significant overreaction. Eli Lilly plans to continue moving the drug through its development pipeline, with a launch plan next year, pending regulatory approval. The final effectiveness and side effects of the competing GLP-1 pills from competitors like Novo Nordisk is still not known. Plus, Eli Lilly's injectable GLP-1s are still the most effective weight loss drugs on the market, delivering weight loss exceeding 20% in the highest doses. The overall weight loss market is still largely untapped, with only about 4% of Americans currently using the drugs, while 40% of the population is obese. Eli Lilly will continue to be one of the biggest winners from this trend, and it's just getting started. Analysts estimate the overall market will grow from around $50 billion today to between $100 billion to $150 billion by 2030. The sell-off created an opportunity to acquire Eli Lilly at just 25x next year's earnings estimates, based on forward price-to-earnings, P/E, ratio. That's the cheapest valuation since the GLP-1 boom officially kicked off in mid-2021, when Novo Nordisk secured the first approval for using the drugs as a weight loss treatment, and before Eli Lilly launched its competing version of Mounjaro in mid-2022. And we're not the only one seeing a bargain in shares of Eli Lilly. Five top Lilly executives have purchased $2.9 million in LLY shares since August 8, including CEO David Ricks. Action to take: buy Eli Lilly, NYSE, LLY, up to $700 per share. 3. British American Tobacco, NYSE, BDI. British American Tobacco, NYSE, BTI, owns the second largest portfolio of tobacco brands in the U.S. behind Altria, including Camel, Lucky Strike, Dunhill, Cool, and others. Why we recommended British American Tobacco? Not only does British Tobacco own the second largest portfolio of tobacco products, it also owns the second largest portfolio of less harmful tobacco alternatives, including its Vuse vaping product and the Velo brand of nicotine pouches. The company is the world's second largest nicotine company, last year generating $33 billion in revenue and $10 billion in free cash flow. That puts it just behind the number one industry leader, Philip Morris International, PM, which generated $38 billion in revenue and $11 billion in free cash flow last year. Yet, despite generating 90% of the free cash flow as its top competitor, British Tobacco's $125 billion market capitalization reflects a more than 50% discount to Philip Morris' $255 billion market capitalization. We believe this valuation gap will narrow significantly, sending shares of BDI higher. Why British American Tobacco is a best buy? Vuse is the dominant vaping brand among Food and Drug Administration, FDA-approved products available in the U.S., with roughly 50% of the legal market share. The problem is, illegal Chinese vape imports have taken over the U.S. vaping market, with anywhere from 50% to 80% of the total market share. With U.S. and Chinese officials still in the middle of tariff negotiations, significant trade restrictions on Chinese imports are likely to mean increased customs inspections, which in turn should reduce the flow of illegal Chinese vaping products into the country. In the meantime, President Donald Trump's FDA Commissioner, Dr. Marty Makary, has already acknowledged that slowing illegal Chinese vape imports is a top priority, and roughly a dozen states are independently cracking down on illegal vapes as well. Given the growing support among both state and federal regulators, we believe it's simply a matter of time before the flow of illegal Chinese vapes slows dramatically. And with Vuse already the clear market leader among FDA-approved vaping devices, we believe British Tobacco will become the major beneficiary. Best of all, with 50% of its revenue coming from overseas, BTI also offers a built-in hedge against further tariff-related declines in the US dollar. We believe the market has underappreciated the strength of British Tobacco's smoke-free portfolio, with a series of positive catalysts set to unlock its growth potential in 2025. As a result, the business trades dirt cheap at 12x this year's expected free cash flow. With a 5.7% dividend yield, investors get paid to wait for the market to realize its growing potential as a leader in the smoke-free revolution. Action to take: buy British American Tobacco, NYSE, BTI, up to $60 per share. Every month, we highlight three current portfolio picks that are at an attractive buy point, and we include those with the best buying opportunity as our best buys. While we regularly alternate which companies we list as our best buys, removing a stock from the list does not necessarily mean we no longer recommend it to its buy-up to price. It's only that the new picks present an even more compelling investment opportunity. Porter & Company, Stevenson, Maryland.